It's always important to understand what you're doing in the lab, of course, but there's the added reason today that this is what your third and final and most valuable report is about. So make sure you understand this stuff before you write about it. And by the way, don't even think about doing this report until the other one is handed in and graded. Okay? We're doing a new technique today, a new measurement technique. I'll talk more about the actual goal of the experiment in a minute once I find pens. But the new measurement technique we're doing is called spectrophotometry. You can tell it's a measurement technique because it ends in metry. Spectrophotometry is an indirect measurement technique. By that I mean that you are measuring concentration of something in general. I'm not talking about just today. Spectrophotometry in general measures concentration of some sort of solute that you're interested in, but not directly. Think about what the definition of concentration is. There's different units you can use, right? Like molar, which is what the one that we use in this course. But think about what molar means. Molar means moles of solute per liter of solution, right? A direct measurement of that would mean you go in there and count the number of moles of solute in a liter of the stuff. Well, you don't live nearly long enough, even if you counted quickly, to count even one mole. It's an enormous number. You're not going in there and actually measuring particles, counting particles, I mean. So it's an indirect measurement, but it's useful in science because it's often valuable information to know how much of a solute there is in that. Even if you know what kind of solute it is, you still don't necessarily know what the concentration is, okay? Well, for spectrophotometry, you need to know what kind of solute you're working with because you need to set up the machine properly, and the machine is called a spectrophotometer. These used to be much bigger devices, big benchtop models back in my day, but now they're small enough to fit in that little plastic thing. Go ahead and take your spectrophotometer out, and you can see how small they are. Eventually, once I shut up, you will need one computer per group, but it has to be these computers because you need the software that's on it to run this machine. Anyway, notice that the spectrophotometer has a little hole in it. That's where you put a special tube that contains your sample. The special tubes, by the way, are called cuvettes. But anyway, the reason this is an indirect measurement of concentration is because what we're directly measuring is something other than concentration, and then we can really calculate concentration from that. If you were to look under the hood of the machine, any kind of spectrophotometer basically, you have a light source in there, just a lamp at one end, and it shines white light. Now, we haven't talked much about light yet because we haven't gotten to photosynthesis, but we will soon. Light, though, is electromagnetic radiation, and it has both wave-like properties. You can think of it as waves in one sense, but it also has particle-like properties, even though they're not, they don't have mass. They're like particles of light, of energy called photons. And when you think about it in waves, there are different wavelengths. The distance from one part of the wave to the next repeating part of the wave is a wavelength. What we call different colors is really just different ways that we perceive different wavelengths of light. All right? But white light is the combination of all wavelengths and therefore all colors. If you mix all colors together, it looks white to us. And that's what the lamp is shining. A beam of white light containing trillions and trillions of photons of all the different wavelengths. On the other end is the well, the hole in the machine where you put your sample. We're looking at it from the top. So you'd put your tube in here, your cuvette into here, right? But after the lamp, you have a prism. And what happens when you shine white light through a prism? Bending in the light rays, which is called refraction. And depending on the color, which is really the wavelength, different photons get bent a different amount, which is why white light coming in comes out as individual colors of light going in different directions, just like on the cover of Dark Side of the Moon. Right, each one of these is its own color: red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. The reason this is important is because when you set up the device for your particular solute, you want to make sure that the light that reaches the tube, the cuvette that has your sample in it, will be just the right color or wavelength of light that that particular solute absorbs well. Photons are these particles of light that I was talking about. Well, when a photon encounters an object, there's three basic possibilities. It can be transmitted, which means it just goes right through that material, like light through a window. It can be absorbed, and if it gets absorbed, it no longer exists. The photon is no longer there. The energy that it was carrying is now in the thing that absorbed it. This is why photosynthesis works, by the way, because plants absorb energy by absorbing those photons. But the third possibility is that it will be reflected. It'll bounce off in some other direction. Okay? Spectrophotometers rely on the absorption possibility. Only certain materials absorb photons of a given wavelength or color. We call things that absorb photons in the humanly visible range pigments. That's why they look colors to us, because they absorb some photons and let the others come to our eyes. I'll talk more about that in the photosynthesis lecture. But anyway, to use a spectrophotometer to indirectly measure concentration, you have to be working with a particular type of solute that is able to absorb the photons that the machine is capable of producing at the lamp. Not only that, though, you need to make sure that just those, to get the best sensitivity, the highest quality output, you need to make sure that your sample is receiving just that color of light and not all of it. That's why, by twisting this prism, you can determine, okay, I want red, but only red to go here. The rest of it will just go off to the side and never reach this sample. Okay. Now, another important thing about a spectrophotometer is that it doesn't ever make absolute measurements. An absolute measurement is one that stands on its own. The output of a spectrophotometer is always comparative, which means it has a value compared to some standard value. And that's why you have to calibrate the instrument to give it that standard value that it can compare the other values to. All right? And you do that with a special solution called a blank. The blank, which depends on your experiment, the blank will have all of the ingredients that your solutions of interest have, except none of the solute that you're interested in detecting. So it'll be like all the other things you're doing, just with no solute in it. If you put that blank in, which by definition has none of the solute you're looking for, and you set it up with just the right kind of light for that type of solute, even though there's none in this one, to absorb, well, at the far end of this, there is a collection screen where the photons, if they make it through, can hit. And that turns into electrical signal, and that's what causes the output of the machine. But when you put your blank in there, some of these photons, of course, are not going to make it all the way through. They're going to get maybe absorbed by the glass a little bit or bounced off. But some number of photons are going to make it through because there's no solute in here to absorb them. And however many photons make it through, when you zero the machine, you're effectively telling the machine all of the photons went through, even though they didn't. You're just pretending that all of them did. In other words, zero absorption of photons took place. That's when you're zeroing the machine. That is the baseline value that all your others are compared to. That's what I mean by it's not an absolute measurement. It's always comparative. Once that's set up, which you do only once, then you can, as long as you know you're working with the right type of solution, in other words, there's some amount of solute there, you just put the unknown samples in and get a reading, and the same amount of light comes into the tube as when you blanked it, when you zeroed it, but less is going to make it all the way through because there's solute in there, and those solutes are absorbing that light. Well, the higher number, and therefore the higher the concentration of the solute particles, the greater the chance that photons are going to be absorbed and not make it through. And so less light making it through gets output by the machine as a higher absorbance value. That's what the output of the machine is, absorbance values. There aren't really any units to it because it's one unit divided by the blank unit, and the units cancel. So it's a dimensionless quantity. But it has a value. Even though the book says, kind of uses ABS for absorbance as a unit, it's not really a unit. Well, the bigger that absorbance value is, the greater the concentration is. That's why we're using this machine for this experiment today, because to interpret our results, we need to know what the concentration of our solute of interest is. Anyway, that's how a spectrophotometer works in general. Now, for the experiment itself, I want to explain a little bit about it. The introductory pages that I said you should have already read, that's all just made up story. It's just to supposedly make it entertaining for you. It really has no basis in reality. There's no such thing as that company, whatever, BIMCO or whatever. It's just a made-up backstory. I'm going to tell you what's actually happening. We're investigating how well an enzyme works in today's lab. That's why it's called the enzyme lab. You already know that there are many, many different kinds of enzymes, right? And each one is specific. Not necessarily uniquely specific, but enzymes are specific, which means they work on either one or just a very few number of highly related substrates. Yeah?
Yeah, I missed a thing in my things. The thing that actually matters.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going to do that.
Okay, can you listen at the same time?
Yeah.
Okay. The enzyme of interest today, I don't remember what the story says it is, but the real name for the enzyme that we're investigating is lactase. You can tell that's an enzyme, right? Lactase is a hydrolytic enzyme, first of all. Not all enzymes are. A hydrolytic enzyme is one that accomplishes hydrolysis, which you already know is the breaking apart of some bigger thing into smaller things. This also happens to be an enzyme that is named for its substrate, not for what it does. The normal substrate that lactase, the enzyme, works on is lactose, which you should know is a sugar, right? How big a carbohydrate is lactose? What kind of sugar is it? It's a disaccharide, which means it's made of two monosaccharides that are hooked together by a glycosidic linkage, right? Lact means what? What is lactation? What is it? Production of milk, right. Lact means milk. Lactose means milk sugar. So there's lactose in milk, and that's why people who are lactose intolerant can't have dairy products. But anyway, lactose as a disaccharide, if you break it apart, will give you the two monosaccharides that it's made out of, which are glucose, you're already familiar with that, and galactose. Hydrolyzing lactose, breaking it apart, can happen on its own, but it will happen a lot more quickly, of course, if you give it the help of an enzyme, specifically lactase. Lactase's job normally is to split lactose into glucose and galactose. Okay, now, our goal today is to, in both experiments, is to figure out conditions in which this enzyme is doing its job the best. Remember, we talked about optimum pH, optimum temperature, and the conditions in which an enzyme works best is an important thing to know. How do you know how well an enzyme is working? By seeing whether it's doing its job. The job of any enzyme is to turn reactant or substrate into product. The faster that is occurring, the better the enzyme is working. Clear? Yeah. Oh, don't worry if I go over. Just keep waiting until I'm done. So that's really what we care about, how well an enzyme is working under different conditions in both experiments. But if you think about answering that question, how well is it doing its job of converting substrate into product? There's two ways you could measure that if you had a spectrophotometer. Because spectrophotometers measure concentration, right? It tells you how much of the stuff you have. The two ways you could measure it is to either measure how quickly the product appears, because unless the reaction is occurring, no product is appearing, right? So you could think of it as the accumulation of product. Or you could also measure the rate of disappearance of the substrate, because you're not going to make any product unless you turn substrate into product. As if it's happening well, then the substrate should disappear rapidly. And you could do either one and get the same results. The problem here, and the reason they had to make up this story, is that you can't do either way with this particular experiment, because lactose, the substrate, is invisible to the spectrophotometer. We can't set it up to detect lactose. The light just goes right through it. Okay, so that's out. You can't do it by disappearance of substrate. Well, glucose and galactose, the two products, they're also both invisible. So none of these three things is detectable with the spectrophotometer. That's the problem. And that's why we need to use a surrogate or replacement substrate. And that It's called OMPG. Which is an acronym. It's not a chemical symbol. If you're curious, you don't have to memorize this, but that stands for ortho beta D beta dextro. Oh no, ortho nitrophenyl beta dextro galactopyranoside, which is why we call it ONPG. It's a lot easier to say. But ONPG, as complicated as the name is very similar to lactose. It's also, like lactose, built by two things that are hooked together. And it has an overall shape that is similar enough to lactose's shape that it will also fit into the active site of the lactase enzyme. Okay? And remember when we talked about competitive inhibition, right? Something other than the normal substrate that can fit into the active site would disallow, if it gets in there, will disallow the normal substrate from getting in there. So it's competitive inhibition if you have both present. But the reason we're using ONPG, well, let me tell you the two parts that it's made out of. If you split ONPG into its two parts, just like lactose can be split, the two parts are galactose same one part as lactose has, but the other part, instead of being glucose, is O-nitrophenol. Okay, now, just like lactose, ONPG is also invisible to the spectrophotometer. So we can't, even using this other substrate, we still can't measure disappearance of substrate because we can't detect substrate. Galactose, I already told you, is invisible, so we can't measure appearance of galactose. But O-nitrophenol is detectable by the spectrophotometer. O-nitrophenol, if it's in the solution, will make the solution, to our eyes, look yellow. And the yellower it gets, the higher the concentration there is. But just calling something kind of yellow or very yellow according to your eyes, that's only a qualitative measurement. There's no numbers put to that. You want a quantitative measurement. The spectrophotometer can see the difference that your eye can't detect between two samples. So you, by setting up the spectrophotometer with to detect O-nitrophenol and blanking it first and then putting in your samples that contain varying amounts of this, you'll get different absorbance values. The higher the absorbance, the higher the concentration of O-nitrophenol. And the manual explains how to turn the absorbance value, use the absorbance value to calculate a concentration. Okay? So your raw data are absorbance values, but you calculate those into what you really care about, which are concentrations per time. I mean, concentrations, which can also give you an amount of buildup per time. Is that all clear? Okay, now, using the instrument, you just need to explicitly follow the instructions on the laminated card. You only need one computer per spectrophotometer. Now, there are two available spectrophotometers still, so keep that in mind. If you're waiting on the other group at your table and no one else has taken these spectrophotometers, good call, you're already hogging it, then you can work together and get out of here. But anyway, it doesn't take long to get your numbers. It takes longer to calibrate it, to set it up, than it does to get your values. Once you have it properly set up, and some of you might need my help to make sure you're calibrating it correctly, once you already have it zeroed, then getting your values for all your other samples is just a matter of taking the blank out, putting another one in, and reading a value from the machine, writing it down. That's it. And that's all you need to do for the experiment while you're in here today. Once you have your raw data, you know, you're doing all your writing and everything at home. Except that you also need to, before you leave, make a whiteboard today if you're interested in the bonus points. So just like that second one, which is not even due yet, is it?
No,
the 29th. Yeah, 29th. You'll get bonus points for that if you did your whiteboard last time. Well, you're doing another whiteboard today, but it's a little bit more involved, and it depends on the experiment. So each subgroup needs to make a whiteboard, and ideally you kind of present it to the other subgroup at your table to explain what you did in your experiment, and they'll explain it to you. Even though you need to understand both of them in terms of quiz questions, for instance, when you write this up eventually, you only have to write up the part that you actually did, not both experiments. Is that all clear? Okay. The whiteboard involves drawing a rough graph. That is not the graph for your report. That's just for your bonus points, and it's just part of the bonus points. It's more than just a graph you're drawing. But just make sure you give me a proper graph, too, to get full points. But besides drawing a graph, you're also drawing a little cartoon of what's happening at the molecular level. So it can be done any number of ways, but you're just basically making cartoon pictures. And if you need help, actually, with people do this a lot of different ways, and sometimes they put in way too much work. So ask me if you're unsure about how to draw that. But just like before when we dealt with the whiteboards, make sure everyone has a copy, a photograph, before you erase them, but make sure you do erase them before you leave. Also, let me repeat, so that no one makes a mess for the crew, that these mislabeled jars, they should be labeled tip, use tips only. That's the only thing you should put in these. No liquid at all. The liquid goes in the hood. When you are done for the day, make sure you put your computers back, of course, but make sure they're entirely off, not just closed. Otherwise, they'll overheat in here because there's a lot of them in here. Not only totally off, but make sure you plug it in so the next group has charged computers. All right. Oh, wait a minute. Another couple things about the report. Unlike normal graphs, where you have three or more points, you're used to fitting some trend line to them. Well, that's not appropriate, especially for the temperature one. For the temperature one, just give me the dots wherever they are for the three. Don't try to fit a line or anything. What you care about is which one has the highest value, because that's the one that's the temperature at which that enzyme works the best. For the lactose one, that could be fitted with a curve, but you don't have to. All right, now I'll let you leave.